It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we meet a Wisconsin filmmaker who introduces us to the world of early generation rappers and what happens when they turn into grown-ups.
First, new data from the Milwaukee Health Department shows that in the past years, preterm birth was the leading cause of infant mortality in 2014. It results in more infant deaths than all other causes, including dangerous sleeping conditions.
Dr. Joffrey Swain is with us to talk about the problem and how it's affecting communities across Wisconsin. He's the medical director for the City of Milwaukee Health Department and a professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Swain, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's get our basics out here. What is preterm birth? Is that what we used to call premature birth?
Yes, preterm birth and premature birth are two words meaning the same thing, specifically a baby born before 37 weeks of gestational age. A full-term baby is 40 weeks.
And what's the relationship then between preterm birth and infant mortality?
So it turns out that there are several different reasons why babies die before their first year of their first birthday, and that's what we refer to as infant mortality. And those include birth defects, they include unsafe sleep conditions, and they include preterm birth. And it turns out that preterm birth is by far the most important cause of infant death.
So on the flip side then, and we've been talking about infant mortality, especially in Milwaukee, for some time now, if we can end preterm births or cut down on those, bring babies to full term, they're going to be less likely to die before a year old. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct, and that is exactly why we need to put much more effort into reducing or preventing preterm birth. And not only because it will reduce the number of infant deaths, but also because preterm birth is a serious problem even for babies who live, and most preterm babies do live.
And how big a problem is this in Milwaukee, in the state, and in the country as a whole?
Well, preterm birth is a very big problem in Milwaukee, in the state, and in the country as a whole. So in Milwaukee, for example, we have about 10,000 babies born each year, and about 11% of them, or 1,100 in an average year, are born premature. So that's a lot of premature babies. Statewide, the numbers are proportionally larger, and you have over 7,000 premature births in the state every year. And nationally, again, about little over 11% of all babies born, so one in nine babies who are born in this country are born too early.
Talking to Dr. Joffrey Swain about preterm births, a major problem, a major risk for infant mortality, a major cost in our healthcare system. So what are the causes? I'm assuming it's not just random. What makes preterm births happen, Dr. Swain?
Well, there are a number of different causes for preterm birth, and there some of them are not all that well understood, but there are some that we know very, very well. So, for example, there are some that relate to individual behaviors of pregnant women or family members. Smoking is a very significant cause of preterm birth. Other issues include chronic medical conditions like high blood pressure or diabetes, for example, during pregnancy that can lead to preterm birth. Even just the fact of a woman having had a previous premature birth makes her more at risk for a subsequent premature birth. And then some of the most important causes may be a little surprising to some listeners, but they have to do with neighborhood conditions and stressors in life. It turns out that the more high levels of chronic stress a woman is under, not only during her pregnancy but throughout her childhood and early adulthood, the more likely she is to deliver prematurely. And there's physiologic reasons for it having to do with stress hormones that affect the uterus and make it more irritable and more likely to start contracting too soon during pregnancy.
We'll get into solutions to some of those problems in a moment, but I wanted to bring out another racial disparity. This one, African-American babies more likely to have a preterm birth. Why is that?
So it is true. In fact, across the state and around the country, African-American women are about 60% more likely to have a preterm birth than white women, and there are reasons for that, but One thing that's important for your listeners to understand is those reasons are not genetic. There's very, very good data showing that this is not a matter of differences in genetics between blacks and whites. In fact, the most likely explanation is the point that I made earlier about chronic stress. African Americans, unfortunately, in this country are more likely to be poor than whites. They're more likely to be unemployed. They're more likely to have family members who are incarcerated. They're more likely to live in neighborhoods that have higher levels of violence. They're basically exposed, on average, to higher levels of chronic stress. And this toxic stress, again, affects these stress hormones, and they directly cause women under this conditions to be more likely to deliver their babies prematurely.
All right, this sounds like a hard one to solve. What is a public health intervention that can deal with background baseline stress that somebody experiences for really a lifetime?
Right, so I think the public health interventions, again, are in all three of these areas that I mentioned before. So we do need to help people work on individual behaviors, the most critical one being smoking. In Wisconsin, about a quarter of women report smoking during pregnancy, which is somewhat shocking. And so we need to put more resources into systems that support women stopping smoking, preferably before they get pregnant in the first place. The second thing that I mentioned before in terms of public health interventions is around access and quality to prenatal care. And these range from making sure that clinics are open in the evenings or on weekends when women are working, to making it easier for women to take time off work to go to the doctor while they're pregnant, and then making sure that providers do an optimal job of taking care of these chronic conditions like high blood pressure and diabetes. And then to get to this bigger question of how, from a public health point of view, do we deal with these life course stressors, that's where I think we need broad community and policymaker support for several key kinds of policy interventions that can help people's daily stress go down. So just to give you one example, when we're talking about women that are living in high levels of poverty, the Earned Income Tax Credit is has been proven by some really excellent research that states that have more generous Earned Income Tax Credit have lower rates of preterm birth and lower rates of low birth weight. So that's one kind of policy solution. We've got lots of others ranging from transitional jobs to treatment alternatives to prison for people with nonviolent drug abuse, substance abuse problems. And all these things help strengthen families, they help strengthen communities, they help strengthen women, and they lead to stronger babies.
Now, setting the infant mortality itself aside, these are things that are going to cost money, all the interventions you mentioned. Does it pay off given what the costs are here on the healthcare system?
Well, let's put it this way. On average, a premature baby costs about $50,000 more than a full-term baby. And so when we have in Wisconsin nearly 7,000 preterm births per year, you're talking about close to $350 million a year in just healthcare costs that we spend on these premature babies. And that's a lot of money. That's more than the cut to the UW system and the K-12 system combined that's being proposed right now in the budget. Furthermore, every week that a baby is born earlier than it's supposed to, it's chances of doing well in school go down. And there's some very good research out recently showing third grade reading and math test performance goes down even for babies that are born at 38 weeks compared to babies born at 39 weeks. And it's really bad when you start getting below 37 weeks. So we pay for this up front in healthcare costs, and we pay for it down the road in terms of the productivity and the ability of future generations to contribute to society. It's a very, very serious drain on our economy and on our society.
As we wrap up, Dr. Swain, are you seeing any kind of improvement over the long term on preterm births?
Well, the improvement is happening very, very slowly, and that's why we're so concerned about this. The racial disparities are staying high, and the improvements are just really coming at a snail's pace, and that's really why we're trying to raise this alarm. It's not just that babies are dying, and they are across the state, but it's that so many are born too soon at a great cost to us financially and socially.
Dr. Swain, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's Dr. Joffrey Swain, Medical Director for the City of Milwaukee Health Department and Professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, with us to talk about preterm births and how they affect communities around the state. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk about a bill that would restrict what food stamp recipients can buy with their benefits. It's making its way through the legislature. A cost analysis yesterday said it would cost millions.
First, Wisconsin filmmaker Paul Yannacchino wanted to know what happens when rappers grow up. It's a question that could stand in for a lot of passions from our younger years that we hold on to as we get older. A former DJ himself, Yannacchino has deep roots in the East Coast music scene, which gave him access to interviews with rappers all over the country.
The rappers in the film aren't teenagers. They aren't at the vanguard of hip-hop anymore. They're from the early generations of rappers. Some of them have kids and mortgages and long-standing careers and a track record of life on the road.
In adult rappers, we get to know what it means to stick with a music career that you can't always explain to other people right off the bat. What do you tell people you just met about what you do for a living?
A lot of times I'm just like, I'm a DJ, even though I'm not at all a DJ. It's easier to say that than to explain what I do. And then they ask, like, well, who do you work with? And, like, they haven't heard of it, so it doesn't matter. You know, it just doesn't matter. I'll say I'm a musician. I'm an electronic musician. Depending who's asking me, the answer will be different, you know?
I'm now fully comfortable. I'm, like, on my way out of my job. I'm fully comfortable just telling people I'm a rapper. Unrepentantly.
Paul Yannacchino joins us now. He's a Wisconsin filmmaker and award-winning commercial director. He's the director of the documentary Adult Rappers. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So when did you first start thinking about this question? What happens when rappers grow up?
It's half a joke and half real life, because I had a little bit of a middling music career and a lot of friends that were still pursuing that career. And so it was very topical. We were, you know, getting older and folks were getting married and having families and whatnot. And we would discuss a lot of the time, how long is it viable to be a road dog, to be a touring, you know, musician. And the joke part of it came from, I had moved away from the music business or the, you know, pursuing that as a career, and I was working, and my phone rang from someone from my past and had left a message. I hadn't spoken to them in probably a decade. And I joked to the friend that I was working with that I have too many adult rappers in my life. And we said that would be a great idea for a film. And it started as a joke and then turned into something that we really, you know, wanted to pursue actively.
Do you think there's something universal about it? Even though this is specifically about this group of people, it's about rappers, it's also sort of universal. People go for something that they're passionate about when they're young. It's kind of risky. They pursue it, but then maybe they don't want to let go of it when they grow up. Do you see it as a universal?
Absolutely. And people ask me all the time to describe the movie or to give you a log line or, you know, summarize it in two sentences. And I tell them it's not a hip hop documentary. It's a story about anyone who wants to pursue a passion, but it's delivered in a hip-hop package. So it's, you know, it's definitely, it's told through these stories of people that are road dogs, that I call them blue-collar rappers. You know, none of them are household names. That's how they make their living. But I think it's completely relatable to someone who's a screenwriter or a painter or, you know, pursues their craft on and tries to sell it on Etsy. You know, it's the same sort of thing. It's just that these guys, you know, honed in on a hip-hop lifestyle and pursuing a specific art form.
Let's talk about some of the people you profiled. I'm imagining that you knew a lot of these people from your former experience on the East Coast music scene as a DJ. Who are some of these guys? And there's some women, too.
Yeah, some of them are so I was part of a group and signed to a record label in New York. So we started with friends and talked to those people that we knew first person first, and then sort of went in concentric rap circles outward from there. So we would reach out to friends of friends, and some of them are people that I know personally. Some of them were folks that we just reached out to and cold called. So there's a, for the Midwesterners, there's, you know, Slug from Atmosphere is in there, and POS from Doomtree. Astronautalist, there's a fair amount of Midwest guys. Soulcon, I think, is the guy who's in the bit at the top, and then I think the clip that you pulled is Esoteric, who's from Boston and who's been a pillar of the Boston hip hop scene for years, for over a decade.
And one of the guys you profiled, maybe it's esoteric, the guy on a lawn.
That's him, yeah.
He's sitting in front of his very suburban-looking house with a lawn that needs mowing. And he's talking about how he's kind of embarrassed that you're sort of blowing his cover, that he's just sort of this regular guy. Here he is.
And so it's kind of hard sometimes to rationalize your own place in this, where you know it's a youth-driven movement, but I'm not so much of a youth anymore.
Yeah, man. You know, I'm 37. I've got a wife, got a son. I'm embarrassed my lawn's not cut. Makes me an adult.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite interviews for sure. He's great. And he is. I mean, you nailed it. He's a very regular guy outside of, it just happens that when he leaves the house, he doesn't leave for 9 to 5. He leaves for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and goes on the road, you know, and but then ships his own CDs to his fans, which was the other part of that interview, which is great.
Just from that shot that you get of him during those interviews, he looks like a soccer dad. Mm-hmm. You would never know that he was a rapper. Can you be a rapper that gets respect and success and be a dad? I mean, is that changing now? Maybe there was more anti-old person bias in rap, but maybe it's going away now. And by old, I mean 30s and 40s.
Right. I think it, you know, I think it is changing. I think there's the thing to distinguish these guys from sort of what I think most people hear on the radio is, and again, I always say, you know, blue collar rappers, they're all independent artists. None of them are signed to, predominantly, none of them are signed to major label contracts. They live on the road for 200 plus days a year. They really are, you know, some of the hardest working people in the entertainment business. And I think it is easier because there's a lot of non-traditional careers these days. You know, it's not not everyone's going to be a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher. And I think more people are used to seeing their kids say, yeah, I don't want to go to college. Maybe I want to try, God forbid, being a rapper, amongst other things.
And at one point, there's a kind of a funny part, well, telling part of the movie, someone says, there is really no template for this, because there are really no older rappers. Folk singers, yes, because that genre has been around for a long time, but not so much rappers. So is this a unique thing we're seeing?
I think it is. And that was another, you know, impetus for the film was, arguably, the genre has just come around to its 40th birthday. So you're in this unique, you know, spot on the timeline in terms of American music where you have this genre that is so young compared to all the other genres. So it's the first time there are 60, 70-year-old rappers. There are some, you know, like Big Daddy Kane that still go and do a major venue a couple times a year, and there's more of these legends and golden era tours because folks our age or people that are in their 30s and 40s, without giving out a number, we'll buy a ticket to go see those shows, you know, and it's the first time that we could say that.
So looking where we started at sort of the biographical start of this film, you were one of these guys. You weren't a rapper, but you were you worked with rappers, mm-hmm. as a DJ. You kind of hung that up. Mm-hmm. You've got kids now. So even though you did this sort of inspirational film about how, yeah, you can be a father, have a mortgage, have a lawn, and do this, would you do anything differently now?
It wasn't for me. I always tell people, I think after having some time away from finishing the film, it's like a love letter and the obituary to my music career. Because I loved it. I wouldn't trade it for anything. But for me, going on a tour bus for weeks at a time, was, I knew immediately it was not for me. And I give massive respect to any artist that's what they do. No matter where they fall on the spectrum, it is a really, really tough job. And that's another great quote from the film. One of my friends, Cryptic, says, people think it's not a real job. They think it's a way of getting a real job. But you work harder than probably any other job you can imagine.
Did any of the people you talked to say that they did have a shelf life? If they hit a certain age or a certain point in their career, that was it, and they were going to go gently into the good night. They weren't going to try to keep going forever.
Well, I mean, you watched it, and not to spoil it, but that's another question that people really struggle to answer. I mean, even guys that are in their 40s, I think it's a really difficult thing to date, to put an end date on your own career, especially when you still believe you can do it. You still think it's, you know, there are promising days ahead. I couldn't find it. I rarely got a straight answer about, is there a finite date that it would be over for you? And more often than not, people felt like, I'll know when it's time, but it's not time yet.
Did anybody hang it up between when you made this film and now?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the more visceral stories to me is Jay Zone, who actually wrote a book and parallels the themes in the book parallel a lot of things we talk about in the film. It's called Root for the Villain, and he tells the story in vivid detail of being on stage at the Knitting Factory in LA and having a handful of people show up for his show, and he was the headliner, and he walked away, and he is sort of, you know, dances around kind of getting back in, but never really does. I can't think of anyone that's in the film that while that happened, they quit, but...
To be continued. Paul, yes. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Paul Iannacchino is a Wisconsin filmmaker and award-winning commercial director. He's the director of the documentary Adult Rappers. It's screening at the Nuff Film Festival in New York City on May 16th. You can also catch it on Vimeo. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at today's federal appeals court ruling on the NSA's phone data collection program.
First, Republican lawmakers advanced a set of bills yesterday which would mandate food stamp recipients buy healthy food with their benefits and not so-called luxury foods.
Also yesterday, details on the cost of that proposal were released with estimates that it could cost millions of dollars to implement. That came at the same time the state learned its revenue estimate would not be revised upwards and remains in a budget deficit.
Here with us now to share the details on the SNAP benefits proposal is Patrick Marley, state government reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, do we have a sense of how much it would cost to implement these food stamp restrictions?
It's incredibly vague. The Department of Health Services has come up with an indeterminate estimate that says only it would cost several million dollars. A lot of this is driven by the software that would need to be installed in grocery stores so that you'd know which food would qualify and which wouldn't, and they just don't really have a good handle on what that would cost.
Now, as I understand it, the federal government would pay for the benefits. The state has to pay for the running of the program.
The state and the federal government share the cost of running the program. The benefits are entirely paid by the federal government. It was about $1.2 billion a year. Running the program is much less than that, and that's a shared cost. This would be a state initiative, so the state would have to bear most of the cost, for instance, of installing this software.
Now, there are two parts to these restrictions. One, that recipients would have to buy a majority of healthy foods, and two, that recipients could not buy so-called luxury foods. And let's start with that first. What is the thinking behind this?
Sure. So there's really the only ban on a so-called luxury food is on lobster, crab, or other shellfish. It just says you couldn't use food stamps for that. And the argument there, the proponents say, is if you're low income enough that you need assistance with groceries, you shouldn't be buying that kind of food. And then the second part of the bill says that two-thirds of your benefit can only go toward certain things that they are deemed healthy or nutritional. There are some things that people typically would think are nutritional that isn't on their list, and they say, well, you can pick that up with the other third of your benefits where you have more freedom on how it's used.
Who decides what's healthy and what isn't healthy?
So they based their list off of the Women, Infants, and Children program, which is another nutrition program where people, women and young children, can get assistance. And that's a more restrictive list than food stamps. So they've taken that list and then they've supplemented it with a few things like most kinds of meat, produce, potatoes, these kinds of things. And they've tried to keep that somewhat limited in a nod to us being the dairy state. They've added all dairy products, so you could buy ice cream, for instance, with your that would count towards your two-thirds of healthy money.
And shellfish is considered one of these luxury foods, as I understand it, including shrimp, which is high in protein. Our producer looked at the cost of shrimp online, found that you can buy a 12-ounce bag for about $5, not too different from costs of other animal protein. So is shrimp really a luxury food? How do we begin to parse these things?
Well, I think that's a good question for the sponsors of this bill. One of the things that they say is that there is no perfect way to determine, you know, there are new products coming out of the market all the time. There's no perfect way to determine what is nutritional and what's not, what would be an appropriate use. But they say we need to put some restrictions in place because if people are getting government money to buy products, the government should have some say into what they can buy.
We're talking right now with Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about Republican state lawmakers who are looking to mandate that food stamp recipients buy what's defined as healthy food and not buy so-called luxury foods, foods that could include shellfish, it looks like. And Patrick, cheese has been also at the center of this, maybe as a sign that we're in Wisconsin, but, you know, sharp cheddar is controversial here as opposed to regular cheddar, as opposed to shredded. I mean, that's right. Just part of the picture here, but what is this getting at big picture?
So the Democrats are opposed to this, and they're trying to portray this as sort of a nanny state move to have people shaming the poor or having the government dictate to the poor what they can buy and can't buy. And so they made a point early on in the process that under the WIC program, which is structured off of, you can buy mild cheddar cheese, but you can't buy sharp cheddar cheese. You can buy a block of mild cheddar cheese, but not shredded mild cheddar cheese. If a block of cheese is too large, you can't use the WIC benefit for that. Now, Republicans have addressed that issue by saying things like brands and packaging are not going to be restricted on this, but the Democrats say there's still just too much government interference with what's going on here, and that it's already hard when you're poor, and if you're going shopping, it shouldn't be more complicated by trying to figure out if you buy a particular item, does it count towards your two-thirds or not? If it does, how close to your two-thirds limit are you? And that it would just make it very impractical for people on these benefits.
What problem do Republican lawmakers see with food benefits that they're looking to solve with these restrictions on what people can buy and can't buy?
Well, they have cited a lot of anecdotal stories. They say that this is being abused, or that they've heard stories of abuse, or that they're concerned that there just aren't enough controls on it in general. They also have tried to address public benefits. You know, this is just one part of a larger package of bills. They also want to have drug testing for people on unemployment insurance. They want to have drug testing for people who get food share in many cases. Some have talked about having a photo on benefit cards so that people know at the grocery store that the person who's buying the groceries is the person who's supposed to get these benefits. They just say that there's a lot of money that's spent on these programs and there should be good oversight of it.
Now, all of this comes at a time when we were fresh off the news from yesterday that there will not be a hike in revenue for the state, according to the latest estimates from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. So how is that being taken into account as we consider a program that looks like it will cost millions?
That's a definite challenge for this bill at this time. 2 years ago, the State Assembly passed a similar bill that was actually broader as to how food stamps could be used, or more restrictive as to how food stamps could be used. That passed the Assembly but didn't even get taken up by the Senate, both controlled by Republicans. So we don't know where the Senate's going to be on this. The Assembly is going to vote on this bill next week, but I think you're going to see pretty tough scrutiny from the Senate given the financial implications. We did in committee yesterday, one Republican joined the Democrats in voting against this. It's Adam Nylon, who said that he just thought it was too costly. Now, one thing the Republicans point out is that the way the bill is structured, you would have to get the federal government's approval to change how we do food stamps. So the bill actually says that the state would write a waiver and request from the federal government to get approval for that. If the federal government said that we could go ahead and put these restrictions in place, then it would go to our legislature's budget committee, and they would at that time determine whether to put it into place. At that stage, they would have a better handle on the cost, and they could figure out if they could have the money available to put this into place. Another thing advocates say is that any costs are really up front on the software, and that there might be one-time expenditure, but then after that, maintaining the system, like other computer systems, would be less costly.
Are there other states who have asked for these kinds of restrictions from the federal government and gotten it?
Other states have asked. No one has gotten it yet.
Now, you said Democrats have used the phrase nanny state when it comes to this proposal. What else have they said?
Well, you know, they've raised concerns about the cost. They've said that this is really trying to stigmatize the poor, is what they say, that they're trying to make people embarrassed about having to get their benefits from the state. That's the essence of their arguments against it.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
We've been talking to Patrick Marley of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a push by Republican state lawmakers to mandate that food stamp recipients buy what's defined as healthy food and not buy so-called luxury foods, foods that include shellfish. A cost estimate for the measure came out yesterday, saying it would cost the state millions to put into place.
Now we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you support restrictions on how public food benefits can be used? What kind of restrictions, if any, do you think should be in place? Should the state consider encourage healthier eating in this way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We just spoke to Patrick Marley of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a measure that Republican lawmakers are moving through the legislature that would restrict what food stamp recipients can buy with their benefits. It would mandate that they buy mostly healthy food and not buy so-called luxury items like shellfish.
Yesterday, the measure was voted through the Assembly Public Benefit Reform Committee, and a cost analysis was released showing that would cost the state millions of dollars to implement.
And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Do you support the measure? Do you receive SNAP benefits? And what do you think about this proposal? How would it change the way people using these benefits would have to grocery shop? Is this a good way to make people healthier, or does it cross a kind of line? Democrats saying this could turn Wisconsin into a nanny state. Well, what is your take? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go first to Jamie. Jamie's joining us from Madison. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. I don't know if we have enough time in your entire show for my comments, so I'll try and keep it brief. I don't know that I think nanny state would be the appropriate term so much as dictatorship or police state, that we're trying to literally control what someone puts in their mouth. Sounds a little ridiculous, not to mention the price tag attached. However, what I'm really curious about is Wisconsin is home to 11 federally recognized Native American tribes who all administer some sort of food stamp food sharing program through the state. And given their sovereign status, I'm not sure that the state has the authority to force them into something like this or their members into that. So I would love to hear anybody's comment on that aspect.
All right. Thank you for your call, Jamie. Patrick Marley has left us, but thank you for raising those questions. Appreciate that. We're going to go next to Tanya in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Tanya.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, I think it's very simple. I've worked as a cashier in food stores for many years, and I continue to be astounded by the number of times, and it's a large number of times, that people have come through my checkout line using their EBT or their SNAP benefits with cartfuls of candy, chips, soda, absolute junk food. I rang up people who spent all of their food stamps for the month buying Easter candy at one point. And I really feel that if you need to be on food stamps, then you need to be on food stamps, not on junk food stamps. And, I mean, shellfish, luxury item, yeah, that's kind of potato-potato to me. I'm thinking that they need to look at some wider restrictions on categorizing what kind of food is truly junk food and eliminating that.
Thank you for your thoughts, Tanya, and sharing your experience. We're going to go next to Cindy in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hi, I'm opposed to this ban on what people can eat. I think it's ridiculous, and I think we have much bigger fish to fry in the state of Wisconsin, and we could use that money for much better purposes than worrying about what people are eating.
All right. Well, thank you, Cindy. And we go next to Melody. Melody's joining us in Rockford, Illinois. Hi there.
Hi.
What are your thoughts?
I am living below the poverty line, liberal in Illinois. I absolutely support restricting what people who are receiving free food that I go to work for and pay for every day what they can eat. Not only should they not be allowed to buy candy and soda and chips, high fat, high sugar foods, because it's not just a luxury, it's poor for their health. And then guess what else? The people who are receiving those benefits are also going to receive Medicaid for diabetes and other obesity-related issues. So I have no problem with it, and I think in the long run, the initial cost will be high, but I think in the long run, you're going to get people off welfare because they don't want to be stigmatized. If you make it easier and easier for them to obtain this free stuff and easier for them to use it and also abuse it, then why wouldn't they take advantage of it? And I know many, many people that do get the benefit from these programs, and most of them smoke pot. So how?
And we leave it there. Thank you, Melody. Appreciate your thoughts. We move next to Philip in Alcorn. Hi, Philip.
How are you doing? Can you hear me all right?
Yep, you're good.
I think this is a horrendous bill. I don't think the person who introduced this bill even bothered to do a cost analysis of how much it would cost as opposed to how much it's going to save. This is nothing more than red meat for conservatives to jump on. They never did one study to indicate whether or not this is really a significant problem, other than stories about I heard or she said or I thought I saw. And in a time when we're already scrambling for money just to put our schools, keep our schools open, this guy's going to propose this. It's a horrendous idea and nothing more than a lot of a waste of time and effort.
And Philip, it's anecdotal, but just based on some of the callers, one a cashier who said she saw people on food stamps buying a lot of Easter candy. Does that worry you, or do you think that there could be a way to encourage people to eat healthier with something maybe similar to this?
Well, I'll tell you what. If you want to encourage people to eat healthier, why don't we look at the school lunches? Now, that's a place where we could encourage people at a young age to start eating more fruits and vegetables. This is just a stigmatization of people who are already on food stamps, and nobody lives high on the hog on food stamps. And, yeah, if they want a bag of candy once in a while, far be it for me to say no, especially at Easter time.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, Philip. And a last call here from Chris in Cambria. Hi there.
Hi. Well, I do support the bill.
Uh-huh, and why?
Well, I think that there are some very good points about it. I think, though, that there should be more restrictions on it. My opinion is that it should be reserved for elderly people. I think that there are many, many young people who are abusing it, and instead of going out and finding employment and jobs and doing what you have to do to put food on the table, they're taking a free ride and they're abusing it.
Are you worried that this could stigmatize people, or that this is not the time to be looking for extra money in the budget?
I think that we should not be looking for extra money in the budget. I think that we should actually cut the program and just use it for the elderly or the sick, you know, terminally ill, things like that. I don't think it puts a stigma on people. You use it, you know. I don't think we look at poor in that way.
All right. Well, thank you for your call, Chris. Appreciate it. Thank you, everybody, for your calls. We've been talking about new proposed restrictions on how food stamp recipients can spend their benefits. You can continue this conversation over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Two years ago today, the nuclear power plant at Kewaunee stopped producing electricity, triggering a potentially six-decade closing process known as decommissioning. Some in the nuclear industry would like to speed up that work and point to what's happening at the former Zion nuclear plant along Lake Michigan, just south of Kenosha. But Chuck Kornbach reports that some people near the Wisconsin border still have safety and financial concerns about the former Zion plant.
The two units of the Zion plant shut down 17 years ago, but the site is far from deserted. Guards are there to check your social security number a day ahead of any allowed visit and look at your photo ID at the gate. Then a guided tour reveals a few hundred people are now taking the plant apart, a process federal regulators call rip and ship. but the most dangerous material with a high level of radioactivity may stay at Zion a long time. It's the spent fuel from the plant. Recently, it was moved in concrete and steel casks a few hundred yards to a concrete pad inside a fence that has barbed wire on top. Mark Walker is vice president with Energy Solutions, the company with the license and contract to decommission the Zion plant. Walker shows off the independent spent fuel storage installation.
And there's your IFC pad right there. 61 containers of spent fuel, and will remain there until the federal government decides what they want to do with spent fuel.
The dry storage worries some nuclear power watchdogs who argue if the former spent fuel water pool at Zion is taken away, it could be unsafe to fix any flaws with the storage casks. Mark Walker says Energy Solutions also has to be careful with less contaminated plant waste that's being hauled to places like Texas and Utah in reinforced and covered rail cars. Could those trains derail like oil and other trains sometimes do?
We're always taking every precaution we can in the transportation of this material. We want to make sure that we safely get it there.
There's also asbestos removal going on in some buildings. Put all the work together and decommissioning Zion could cost nearly $1 billion by the time the job is expected to be finished a few years from now. Much of the money has already been set aside by customers of Zion's owners, the utility Exelon Corporation, and its subsidiary, Commonwealth Edison.
We have the room till 9. I don't think we'll be going over that.
At this community meeting last week, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the public discussed how decommissioning is going as part of the plant's license termination plan. The session nearly did go until 9 p.m., as skeptics like Tom Riley of the public interest group Vista 360 raised numerous questions about financing.
Are we getting a fair shake? Is it being done efficiently and effectively?
Riley says this appears to be the first big nuclear plant decommissioning where a third party, Energy Solutions, or its subsidiary, Zion Solutions, is doing the work instead of a utility. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission's Bruce Watson says his agency's bottom line is no different.
We still inspect them to the same safety standards. We expect the same safety performance.
If Exelon is trying to speed up work at Zion to turn the site into something else, it isn't saying. The firm says there are a number of options, including recreational, commercial, and other uses. It's also too early to say if Dominion, the owner of the Kewaunee plant, will also go the third-party route. Dominion says the rest of Kewaunee's spent fuel will be moved into dry storage by the end of next year, but that dismantlement of the plant isn't scheduled to start until 2069. Chuck Hornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.